the open door, bright lights streamed in. The rain had ceased. The tavern room was crowded. There were tradesmen as well as peasants, men in livery, and here and there a woman. Most people were dressed in dark and rough brown clothing, but some were very elegant in bright colours and fur trim. Midst the cloaks and hoods were hats of more variety than I could reckon. People ate by dipping large chunks of bread into bowls of wine, stuffing themselves, then hurrying away. The talk, loud and spoken quickly, went faster than my ear could catch. What I grasped seemed mostly about the day's market, and that it was a glorious day. Presiding over all was Widow Daventry, louder to my ears than all the people combined. She fairly threw down loaves and bowls of drink on the tables, now and again buffeting men with her fists, or exchanging insults with a boisterous tongue, even as she put coins in her purse, the bread costing a penny, the wine the same. As I watched, more people came in, sat and ate. Midst a swarm of people, mangy dogs wandered. I even saw a pig snuffling up what had fallen to the ground. No one appeared to notice, or even care. At one point, I noticed a young man enter and stand at the threshold, casting his eye about the crowd. I say "I," because I instantly recognised him as the one-eyed man we had seen in the first town in which Bear and I had performed. I immediately backed up some steps. His survey, however, was brief, for he turned and went. I recall Bear saying people would come a great distance for the market day. Even so, I asked myself if it was merely accidental that he came to the Green Man's door. Could he be in search of me or Bear? I hastened up to our room to tell Bear, but he was still asleep. Reluctant to wake him, I returned to the steps to stay on guard. But as I sat there, I found it impossible to escape the sensation that something dangerous was drawing in upon to us. It put me to mind of the snares Bear used to catch the birds we ate, an unseen loop pulled tight until the unsuspecting birds were caught. Perhaps we now were those birds. Chapter 43. I'd been sitting for I don't know how long when Widow Daventry noticed me. For a moment she stared at me as if she'd not seen me before.
"You there, boy,"
she called, avoiding my name, though she knew it perfectly well.
"You're supposed to be in the kitchen."
Taken by surprise, for I was sure I hadn't been told I belonged there, I made no protest, but came down the steps. In haste, she took me by an arm and led me away. Though one or two of the men called out, asking who I was, she didn't answer.
"Where's Bear?"
she asked when we entered the back room.
"Asleep." "You mustn't be seen," she said. "He should have told you."
I made no reply, assuming Bear had told her of the attack on me, and that she felt a need to protect me. If Bear trusted her, I told myself, so should I. I looked about. We were in a kitchen filled with food. On one side stood great barrels. From the smell of them, they contained wine or ale. Against another wall was a brick oven. There were shelves upon the walls where loaves of bread and trenchers lay. They smelled like bliss itself, enough to make my mouth water.
"Make sure the pies in the oven don't burn," the woman told me, handing me a long shovel-like wooden tool. "Place the done ones there," she said, pointing to the shelf. "There are breads ready to bake in there," she added, indicating a wooden chest.
Then she bustled out, but not before saying firmly,
"And stay in here." I peeked into the oven where the pies were baking. With the tool I'd been given, I reached in and fetched out some. Seeing that they were not so brown as those on the shelves, I returned them to the heat. While waiting, now and again adding more wood to the oven fire, I looked about me, amazed anew at the quantities of food I saw. Dangling from a ceiling hook was a piece of meat as large as I had ever seen, spotted thickly with flies. Bunches of herbs, I recognised parsley, sage and rosemary, hung from the ceiling, as did onions and leeks. Turnips and cabbages sat on shelves. Bushels of grain were there. There were clay jars and bowls aplenty, filled with I knew not what. Everything had a different smell, some pleasing, others not. After a while, I rechecked the oven. The pies were now uniformly brown. In haste, I slid them out and attempted to place them on the shelves with the others, all but scorching my hand. One was so hot it slipped from my fingers and fell to the ground, where it broke open. In a panic, I scooped up the pieces and tried to push them together. When the bits failed to stay, I looked for a place to hide the damage, but finding none, I simply ate it, bolting the pieces like a hungry dog. Despite my nervousness and the speed with which I ate, I could hardly believe how rich and fine it tasted, filled with savoury things I'd never eaten and couldn't name. What's more, being hot from the oven, it filled me with a pleasing warmth. Widow Daventry bustled in. "Have you taken the pies out?" Feeling guilty, I said, "I put them on the shelf." She considered them, then me. "Except for the one you ate," she said. She opened the wooden chest and took up 5 unbaked loaves of bread. "Bake these," she said, "but eat no more," she admonished before hurrying out. Embarrassed, I did as I'd been told, being much more careful this time. Still, I confess, the memory of the goodness lingered for a long time in my mouth. After a while, Widow Daventry returned. "Now come with me," she said, and led me into the tavern room. It was empty of her customers. What remained were scraps of bread upon the floor, and mostly empty tankards on the tables. "Gather up the tankards," she commanded, "and bring them to me." I did as I was told. She took them, sloshing out what remained onto the floor. We worked in silence. She seemed tense, but then, as if she'd been thinking the matter over for some time, she said, "Crispin, I'm sorry for your troubles, but if ever a boy could find a good master, you've found him in Bear. As God is merciful, keep him close to his true calling, his juggling and his music. Don't let him mingle too much with those who would cause trouble, because," she looked at me as if I knew something I didn't, "if you don't help him, things could go much the worse for you both." Chapter 44. When Bear finally appeared, he fairly stumbled down the steps, bawling for his breakfast. He hadn't put on his split hat. "Crispin," he said when he saw me standing there, broom in hand, "with the widow demanding 2 pennies a day for our keep, it's good to see you working. Where is the good dame?"
"In the kitchen."
"Be so kind as to fetch her."
When I did, she had me carry in 2 of her meat pies, plus a tankard of ale, which I set before Bear.
"Ah, widow," he said with a grin, "I'm glad the boy is toiling on our bill. For the love of Christ, all need to work honestly for their bread."
"And I trust you will too," she said.
"So I shall," he said, hand to his heart. "Except this morning I've things to which I must attend. Now, I don't want this boy out upon the town again." It will be a mercy if you keep him busy and so reduce our debt. Can you?"
Widow Daventry, who didn't look too pleased, wiped her hands on her vest.
"There's always work in the kitchen. Just join me when he's done," she said to me and started from the room.
At the doorway, she paused.
"Are you meeting with John Ball again?" she asked.
"Widow," Bear returned severely with a glance at me, "less said, less to deny."
She glared, but left us alone.
"Crispin,"
Bear said to me between bites of food and swallows of drink, as I stood opposite him,
"beyond what she tells you to do, you need to attend to your music. Practice in our room, otherwise your sinful caterwauling will turn aside her trade. Now," he said, speaking softer, so only I might hear, "after noon, when my business is over, you and I shall leave Great Wexley."
"I want that too," I said, much relieved. "But can't I go with you this morning?"
"It's of no concern to yours. In any case, you'll be safer here."
"I think someone's spying on us," I said.
"Explain yourself."
"Do you remember the first village we performed in? You teased a one-eyed man."
"Did I? How?"
"You made him angry when you toyed with his mazer. What's more, he followed us into their church. He listened when the priest told you about the boy who killed Father Quinnell. And when there was talk of the reward money, he looked at me closely. And remember, you said we'd be here this day."
"You've been observant," said Bear, attending mostly to his food. "But what of it?"
"That same young man came to the door. He looked around and went away."
"Are you sure?"
I nodded.
"Did he see you?"
"I don't think so."
Bear frowned. "If he's a spy, he's a clumsy one. If he's after you, we don't need to worry. My business will be quickly done. You'll stay here and keep out of sight. Then we'll go."
"But, Bear, I think I saw someone across the alley last night, too."
"The same person?"
"I couldn't tell."
"Crispin," he said, "for one so unwilling to see the world when first we met, perhaps you notice too much now."
"You've been protecting me," I said. "Maybe I should be protecting you." Bear looked around at me and grinned.
"I like the thought. When I'm an old man, I'll remind you of it. But for now, be easy."
When Bear had fairly stuffed himself with food and drunk down the remainder of his ale in one great gulp, he wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and rose up.
"Remember," he said, "this time you must stay here."
Then, without any further words, he left. I followed him out the front door and saw him stride through the crowded street. Just to see him go off made me nervous, and sure enough, as Bear moved through the crowd, I observed the one-eyed man step out into the street and look after him. He was not alone. A man, dressed in the blue and gold livery of Lord Furnival's house, was with him. What's more, the one-eyed man pointed in the direction Bear had taken. I could have no doubt. The young man was after Bear, not me. Even so, when the one-eyed man turned in my direction, I quickly ducked inside. What he might have done, I didn't know, because I raced down the hall to the back door and leapt out into the alley and began to run. As soon as opportunity allowed, I went to the main street and ran in the direction Bear had gone. I had to warn him. Chapter 45. I caught sight of Bear almost immediately. As he was so tall, his bald head all but gleaming, it was easy to follow him as he moved along the main street. Though his long strides kept him beyond my reach, I could follow without being observed. Being the feast of St. John the Baptist, a market day, the streets of Great Wexley were crammed with even more people than the day before. every alley and lane was filled. The noise was deafening. I, who had every reason to stay unnoticed, was grateful for the crowds, and more so when I saw soldiers. Whether they were looking for me, or Bear, or just keeping order, I didn't know. I only knew I must avoid them. Perhaps Bear saw them too, for now he plunged down a narrow side alley. I followed. Here my pursuit proved harder, for he moved faster than before, turning this way and that, almost as if he knew I might be on his heels. Once, twice, I thought I lost him. Fortunately, his great height always gave him away. He'd gone on in this fashion for some time, when I saw him duck into a building. It was a large timbered structure, 3 stories high, the second and third levels leaning far over the alley upon which it faced. On the first, street level, was a large shuttered window. Over the door hung a board upon which an image of a boot had been painted. By this I took it to mean that boots and shoes were made and sold there. At first I hung back, keeping my eyes on the door to see if Bear would re-emerge. He didn't, but a few other men went in, some of them, I thought, looking furtively about as they entered. It was as if they too feared being noticed. Nervous that Bear would be annoyed with me for disobeying his orders a second time, I decided not to go to him, but remained on watch, my eyes alert for either the one-eyed man, soldiers, or men in blue and gold livery. But though the alleyway was full of passers-by, I saw no one that gave me any reason for concern. I was about to move on, with the thought of peeking through cracks in the building's front shutters, when another man appeared. A short man, he had a great dark cloak about him, hiding whatever clothes he wore. The hood concealed his hair. He too looked about, as if to make certain no one saw what he did. Then he entered the house. It was John Ball. There could be no more doubt that this was more of Bear's dangerous business, from which he had warned me to keep away. I had little doubt I'd not be welcome if he discovered I was close. Even so, my curiosity held me. As I passed the building, I discovered a narrow passageway running by its further side. Pausing, I looked about to make sure I was not being observed, then slipped within it. The passageway was narrow, but I easily made my way until I faced a rough stone wall. Having gone so far, I decided to climb it. From the top of the wall I peered down into a small garden of flowers and herbs. The garden was surrounded by 3 walls built of rough stone, the walls being not much higher than the one I'd just climbed. The back of the house served as the 4th wall. The place was deserted. I dropped down into it. Facing the rear of the building, I now discovered a back door had been left partially open. I started to move toward it, only to be arrested by the sound of a passionate voice which said, "That no man, or woman either, shall be enslaved, but stand free and equal to one another. That all fees, obligations, and manorial rights be abolished immediately. That land must be given freely to all with a rent of no more than 4 pennies per acre per year. Unfair taxes must be abolished. Instead of petty tyrants, all laws shall be made by the consent of a general commons of all true and righteous men. Above all persons, our lawful king shall truly reign, but no privileged or corrupt parliaments or councillors. The church, as it exists, should be allowed to wither. Corrupt priests and bishops must be expelled from our churches. In their place will stand true and holy priests who shall have no wealth or rights above the common man." The more I listened, the more startled I was that I understood what John Ball was saying, that he was, in fact, describing the way I had lived, and how it was wrong and could be made right. But as his words went on, I realized, too, how hazardous this business truly was, nothing less than rebellion against the realm of England. Backing away from the door, I managed to climb the wall and moved hurriedly along the narrow alley toward the street. My intent was to return to the inn, there to await Bear and our departure from Great Wexley. Before stepping from the passage between the buildings, I took the precaution of looking up and down the passageway to see if I was being observed, which is how I spied a group of soldiers coming toward me along the street. They were such as I had seen by the town walls, armour on their chests and rusty metal caps on their heads. Broadswords were in their hands, daggers were at their hips. They were being led by a man who wore a vest of chain mail over a quilted blue jacket. In his hands he carried a crossbow. His helmet bore a crest of blue and gold. But I knew him as John Aycliffe. By his side was the one-eyed man. Chapter 46. Hurriedly I pulled back into the narrow passageway, but peeked out, watching as the soldiers paused. The one-eyed man pointed to the sign of the boot that hung from the building into which Bear and John Ball had gone. The moment the building was singled out, I had no doubt as to what John Aycliffe was intending. Wasting no time, I plunged down the narrow passage between the buildings, clambered up the wall, and slipped down into the garden a second time. This time, however, I didn't pause at the rear door, but yanked it open. I looked in upon a small room filled with benches, upon which sat some 7 men, Bear among them. Standing before them was John Ball. "Bear!" I shouted. "Soldiers are coming!" At the sound of my voice, he leapt up and spun about to face me.
"Where?"
"On the street." Even as I spoke, there was a great crash from the front of the house, the door being broken in.
"We are betrayed," John Ball thundered. "Save yourselves."
There was a wild scramble for the rear door as the men, Bear among them, raced to get out. I had to leap aside so as not to be trampled. Once the men were in the garden, Bear took command. Using his great height and strength, he fairly lifted the men onto the back wall, one by one. Once there, they swung their legs over, dropped down, and disappeared. The last to go was John Ball. At the top, the priest hesitated and called,
"Bear, don't lose heart. Put your faith in mighty God and me. We'll meet again tonight at the White Stag."
Then he too vanished. Bear swung about.
"Crispin,"
he said, holding out his arms. I ran to him. He picked me up and all but flung me to the top of the wall. From there I looked into a narrow alley in which people were passing, one or two who looked up at me with nothing more than idle curiosity. Farther down the way, turning a corner, I could just see John Ball scurrying off. I looked back toward Bear. He'd just begun to climb the wall when the soldiers burst out of the house and into the garden.
"Go, Crispin," Bear cried. "Get out of the city. It's you they want, not me."
I dropped into the alley, but instead of running off, I stood in place. Heart pounding, I strained to listen, trying to guess what was happening on the other side of the wall. What I heard were shouts,
"Hold him! Secure him!"
Then came the sound of blows. Finally, as though from a greater distance, I heard cries, a scream, more shouts, then no more. Frantically, but hardly knowing what to do, go to the aid of Bear or take care of myself. I hesitated. Guilt and fear engulfed me equally. Unable to abide, not knowing what had happened, I climbed back upon the wall and looked into the garden. It was empty. I swung over it, dropped back down, ran toward the door and stepped inside. The room where the meeting had taken place was a shambles, nor was anyone there. Opposite the door by which I had entered was another open door. I ran through it, only to find greater disorder. Several low work tables had been overturned. Shoes, slippers and boots, in various stages of manufacture, lay scattered. I went through another door that led me into the front room of the house. On two trestle tables, shoes and boots were displayed, and here a soldier was standing, looking out the broken front door. He turned and saw me. "Halt!" he cried. I spun about and tore back through the rooms I'd entered into the garden. Scrambling over the wall, I made my way along the narrow passageway by the side of the house. Once I reached the street, I hastily looked up and down, saw that it was clear, and ran. Whether or not the soldier came after me, I never knew. All I knew was that Bear had been taken by John Aycliffe. It was as I had feared. We'd been trapped. Chapter 47. Desperate to find where Bear was being taken, I raced wildly through the town, more than once taking the chance to stop and speak to strangers. "Did some soldiers holding a large red-bearded man go by?" I asked. Twice I was told that such a one had just been dragged along. What's more, they were able to point in the direction the soldiers took. I rushed on. Then, as before, I unexpectedly burst into the great square. Though very crowded, I could see a group of soldiers crossing the far side. People were hastily making way for them. Scrambling forward, I wove and dodged through the crowd, tables and stalls, just in time to see the soldiers, with Aycliffe, drag Bear through the open doors of a large building. It was the building I'd noticed before, the one that stood directly opposite the great church. As soon as the soldiers entered with Bear, the doors swung shut. Armed guards, helmets and weapons bright, their livery blue and gold, took up positions before them. Standing there, I was engulfed by alternating waves of rage and helplessness. That it should come to this! In agony, I made the sign of the cross over my heart and made a prayer for Bear's safety. Yet I had little hope that it would bring either comfort or release for my one true friend. If only he had listened to my warning! Then, afraid of being noticed, I stood behind a large man and peeked around him while trying to take measure of where Bear had been brought. "What building is that?" I asked.
"The Furnival's palace," the man replied, "and may God give grace to her ladyship."
I continued to stare at the building as if I might see through the stone walls and discover what was happening inside. But while that, of course, proved useless, I did see a man appear on the second-level balcony, the one underneath which stone lions' heads protruded. It was John Aycliffe. He stood looking out over the square as if in search of someone. As I gazed at him, I had little doubt it was me he was seeking. I watched him, my heart full of loathing, until he turned and went back inside. He had taken Bear to get at me. Not knowing what to do, I made my way back to the green man. Though disconsolate, I kept my eyes alert for soldiers. I saw a few, but didn't think they saw me. Fortunately, by then I'd come to know the town well enough that I reached the inn in good time. but remembering the one-eyed man, I entered through the rear. The house was very quiet, though I knew I should go and find Widow Daventry and tell her what had happened. I was in too much torment. I felt a need for time alone to compose myself and think what next to do. Quietly, then, I crept up to the second-story solar. As I'd expected, our room was empty, but just to see Bear's sack and hat in one corner moved me greatly. Exhausted, I lay down upon the pallet, my mind churning through a clutter of images, things, and words. Again and again the main questions returned. What would they do to Bear? What should I do? The truth was, I felt paralysed. In a spate of loneliness, I felt about inside Bear's sack, found his recorder, and played a melody. It was the first one he had taught me, but to hear it brought such sadness I put it away. Silence was the only voice that could speak to me. But as I lay there, I don't know for how long, I became aware of commotion. At first it appeared to come from the street. Before I could determine what it was, I heard a crash that shook the entire house. I sat up, listening intently. Now the tumult, shouts and cries, came from within the building itself. I heard a scream, followed by sounds of crashing, wood splintering, and I knew not what other violence. Leaping up, I didn't know what to do, until I remembered the hiding place that Bear had told me about. It took but moments for me to slip the wallboard out, as he had instructed. Then I crept inside the opening, taking Bear's sack and hat with me. As soon as I pulled the board back, darkness closed about me. I dared not move. It wasn't long before I heard heavy footfalls burst into the room right beyond my hiding place. "He's not here either," I heard a voice say, followed by the sounds of breakage and finally footsteps receding. I pressed my ear against the wall. When I was certain no one was there, I eased my way out. The room had been completely tossed and turned. The little table had been crushed. Straw from the pallet lay strewn about. With extreme caution, I went out into the hall. It was deserted. At the top of the steps, I listened anew. From below came the sound of weeping. Chapter 48. I made my way down the steps. When I came into the tavern room, I received a further shock. The tables had been smashed, benches were split, the serving counter was overturned, the tankards in which the ale and wine were served lay tumbled about. Many were broken. Midst the ruins sat Widow Daventry. She was slumped and weeping. Her linen cap lay on the floor, her hair, undone, hung down over her broad back. Her smock was torn. Afraid to make my presence known, I stood motionless on the threshold of the room, trying to grasp what had happened. I must have made a sound, for the woman started and shifted her bulk around. She saw me and quickly turned away, but it was enough for me to see the bruises on her face, her red-rimmed eyes, her hollow mouth from which trickled a spike of blood. She gulped for air, and her crying ceased. When I went and stood by her side, she lifted her head, looked at me, and raised a hand, once, twice, as if to pump up words. None came. It was as if she'd been emptied of all life. "Good widow," I stammered, "what happened here?" "Soldiers," she lisped faintly, "from the palace. They're searching for you."
"Will they return?"
"Perhaps," she said wearily. Though I quickly decided not to tell her I'd been in the house, I hardly knew what to say.
"If they find me,
I asked, hoping she would give me a different answer.
"What will they do?"
"Kill you," she said, groaning with the effort. She came to her feet and surveyed the wreckage with a dazed look. When she spied her cap on the floor, she picked it up and poked her fingers through its rents.
"Do you know why?"
I said. Disgusted, she tossed the cap away.
"Best ask Bear."
"Bear's been taken," I said. She swung around.
"By whom?"
"The soldiers."
"When?"
Diminished as she already was, my news reduced her even more. Clumsily, she righted a bench and sat down heavily. Her own weight seemed too much for her.
"Tell me what happened."
I told her all. She listened intently, muttering sacred prayers along with profanities below her breath. When I'd done, she said,
"May Jesus protect him,"
and made the sign of the cross. Then her shaking fingers sought her rosary beads. I said,
"What will happen to him?" "A loving God will grant a speedy death," she said, squeezing her hands together.
Tears began to run down her sunken cheeks again. With a hasty, agitated gesture, she wiped them away. I stood there awkwardly, hardly able to breathe. I said,
"I heard John Ball cry out that he was betrayed."
The woman spat upon the floor.
"Beware all men who confuse their righteousness with the will of God. They probably don't even know that Ball was here. It's you they want. I warned Bear."
She went back to gazing about the wreckage, as if still unable to believe what she saw.
"Widow," I said, "what should I do?"
At first she didn't answer. Then she said,
"You can't stay here. It's too dangerous for you and me. They'll try to get Bear to say where you are. But even if they make him reveal where you are, since they already searched this place and didn't find you, they may not believe him. In any case, Bear will try not to say anything to harm you. He cares too much for you."
Then she added,
"But even the strongest can be broken by torture."
"Torture?" I cried.
"Tonight, after curfew," she went on, "you must escape from town. In the meanwhile, don't even come into this room. Stay upstairs. Did Bear show you where to hide?"
I nodded.
"Go on, then. That's where you need to be."
I climbed the steps and returned to the room. After slipping inside the tiny hiding space, I closed myself in, welcoming the darkness as the only safe companion to my despair. So much bad had happened, and all because of me. Chapter 49. I don't know how much time passed before I heard a tapping on the board that kept me hidden.
"Open up,"
came Widow Daventry's whisper. I pushed the board out. In her hands was a bowl of soup and bread. Grateful, I took the food and began to eat, though I was almost ashamed to be so hungry.
"What have you been doing?"
she asked, after setting down the small candle she'd brought.
"Thinking about Bear."
"Ah," she said with a sigh,
"well, you might. Crispin, forgive me being so angry with you. God knows it's not your fault."
She lapsed into silence for a while.
"Did Bear ever tell you about me?"
she asked abruptly.
"No,"
I said.
"Two husbands, 7 children, none alive. And yet I live."
She reached out and rested a heavy hand on me.
"Crispin," she whispered, "does God have reasons?"
"I don't know."
Head bowed, she began to weep again. I took her rough hand and squeezed it. It was some time before she could compose herself. Cautiously I said,
"Good widow, can you read?"
She looked at me with vacant eyes.
"A little. Why do you ask?" "Can you tell me what it says here?"
I held out my cross. She took it and turned it over in her hands.
"It's from the great sickness," she said. "I don't have to read it. Bear told me what it says."
"He did?"
She nodded.
"It says, Crispin, son of Furnival."
I stared at her.
"Your Lord Furnival's son."
"How can that be?
Who did you think your father was?"
"My mother only said my father died before I was born, in the great sickness." She shook her head.
"Crispin, for these lords to have sons out of wedlock is common."
"And Bear knew about me," I managed to say.
"Yes."
"And he told you?" She nodded.
"He guessed it from this cross and because of what happened to you."
She offered the cross back to me. I took it.
"What else did Bear say?"
She sighed.
"He supposed that your mother was attached to Lord Furnival's court, that she must have been some young gentle lady who knew how to write and read. Bear imagined her some beauty, enough to catch the eye of Lord Furnival. Furnival must have brought her, no doubt against her will, to your village. But when she quickened with child, you, he abandoned her, leaving orders that she be held in that place, not killed, but never allowed to leave."
"Because of me?"
"Yes. Why didn't Bear tell me? He wanted to protect you."
"From what?"
"Crispin," she said, "whatever noble blood there is in you is only poison. Lady Furnival, who's the power here, will never let you have the name. She'll look on you as her enemy, knowing that anyone who chooses to oppose her will use you and what you are."
"Does she even know of me?"
I said, amazed. When the woman said nothing, I repeated the question.
"If she knows as much as I, she may," said the widow.
"What do you mean?"
I cried.
"Crispin, I cannot be certain, but if the rumour of the time, 13 years ago, was true, I believe I know who your mother was. She was the youngest daughter of Lord Douglas. Lord Furnival became infatuated with her. It was the talk of the town. Then word was given out that this young woman died. Apparently not."
"What difference does that make?"
I asked bitterly. "She's dead now."
"But if Lord Douglas knew his daughter had a son by Lord Furnival, he might make a claim to the Furnival wealth through you. And if Lady Furnival knew of you as well, she would do anything to protect her power here."
"Your connection gives no honour, no position. What someone fears is not you, but that you will be used. Can't you see it? Your noble blood is the warrant for your death. It will remain so till it flows no more."
I stared at her.
"Did Bear know this about my mother?"
"I didn't tell him."
"Why?"
"He thought of you as his son. Why put a greater distance between you?"
"Crispin, if it's any comfort, you're probably not the only possible claimant. Considering Furnival's reputation, you're probably only one of many. The House of Furnival will want you all dead."
"But I make no claim."
"Those who know of your existence fear your will, which is why you must get away as fast as possible and never, ever return to these parts."
She reached out and touched me softly on the face with her rough hands.
"May sweet Jesus protect you,"
she said before she took her leave.
Chapter 50. When Widow Daventry left, I lay back down, and in the closeness of the hiding-place I held the cross of lead before my eyes. Though I could see nothing, I stared at it. As I did, I began to see how my new knowledge made sense of the way my mother and I had lived for so many years. Her words about my father, few and bitter. Father Quinnell's saying she could read and write, but never revealing it to me. The way people in Stromford Village looked upon us as different. Aycliffe treating us with such contempt. Her calling me Astor's son, since I was all she had, and that was all she could say. But all the same, christening me secretly with my father's name. No wonder she sometimes clung to me, and just as oft thrust me away. I was her life. She cared for me, yet I was the cause of her destruction. Thus we were foreigners to Stromford, unwanted prisoners. Then the courier had arrived with his document, probably to announce the impending death of Lord Furnival. His protection, such as it was removed. Only then did the words I heard in the forest make sense.
"And am I to act immediately?" "It's her precise command. Are you not her kin? Do you not see the consequences if you don't?"
"A great danger to us all."
The "her" was Lady Furnival. To say I'd stolen money was merely Aycliffe's excuse to declare me a wolf's head. He sought to kill me because of who I was. No, not who I was, but who my father and mother were. For me, as Widow Daventry had said, they cared not so much as a rooster's tooth. Father Quinnell must have known the truth, and he was killed. Again, Aycliffe's hand. And Bear came to know it, but didn't tell me. He was shielding me from the poison in my blood. Now he had been taken, most likely to be killed. All because of me. No, I had to remind myself, not because of me or anything I'd done, but because I was Lord Furnival's son. The only question was, now that I knew who I was, what should I do? Because it was clear to me that they had taken Bear to get at me. Chapter 51. For the rest of the day I remained in the hiding place, thinking. In doing so, I continued to piece together the fragmentary bits of my life and place them together until they became a mosaic. I kept asking myself if I felt different, if I was different. The answer was always yes. I was no longer nothing. I'd become two people. Lord Furnival's son, and Crispin. How odd, I thought. It had taken my mother's death, Father Quinnell's murder, and the desire of others to kill me, for me to claim a life of my own. But what kind of life? I suppose some might have considered me blessed in that I was of high blood, but I knew that blood, as Widow Daventry had said, to be nothing but venom. That Lord Furnival was my father had been but a cruel burden. Bear, in the short time I'd known him, was a thousandfold more a faithful father to me. For the first time I began to think upon John Ball's words. They made sense. For what I recalled most was his saying that no man or woman either shall be enslaved to any other, but stand free and equal to one another. I recall, too, what Bear had told me, that he was a fool because he should like to be in heaven before he died. I saw it then. Bear and Ball were talking about the very word Father Quinnell had used, freedom, something I had never had, nor did anyone in my village or the other villages through which we had passed. We lived in bondage. To be a Furnival was to be part of that bondage. As time passed in the darkness of my hiding place, the one thing I knew for sure was that as Bear had helped to free me, he had given me life. Therefore, I resolved to help free him, even if it cost me that new life to do so. Chapter 52. It was shortly after the church bells rang for late afternoon vespers that the widow reappeared. "I've found someone to help you escape Great Wexley," she said. "You'll go tonight. The man knows a safe way over the walls. If all goes well, you'll not be seen." "But what about Bear?" "In the name of God, Crispin," she said, "you cannot help him. He's already lost." She started to leave. "Where do you think I should go?" I said. She shrugged. "Go as far away as possible. Bear spoke of going to Scotland. Perhaps out of the kingdom is best." "I don't know where Scotland is." "To the north," she said. "When will your man come?" I asked.
"After Compline and curfew. Pray for clouds."
"Why?"
"It will be darker."
"Widow," I said as the woman moved to leave me, "where is the white stag?"
"By the western gate. Why do you ask?"
Not wishing to mention John Ball, whom she seemed to hate, I said, "Bear spoke of it." She smiled grimly.
"I'm sure Bear, God keep him, spoke of many taverns."
I fell asleep, only to waken at the sound of ringing bells. Shortly after, I heard the tramp of feet outside. Then, from some distance, came the cry,
"The hour of Compline is at hand!"